he arranged for the elephant to go to a sanctuary. But the love between this little man, he's just a delightful looking man, but it's this big elephant in the photograph. And this little man with kind of a black top hat on, sitting in front of the elephant and hugging the elephant's trunk. And you can just feel the love, but also the sadness in the man. Mm. So look at that photograph. It's quite lovely. But so let's look for the documentary, One Lucky Elephant. Isn't that a wonderful picture?
It really is. That's really great.
Yeah, yeah. It's just It's just precious. So it sounds like it's a great documentary and really supports. Gee, maybe we ought to ask the Woodland Park Zoo to bring it in.
Yeah, that'd be an idea.
Yeah. Don't think they do it, but
it's too bad people put elephants in circuses.
Yeah, yeah. Show that to Gary. He'll like that. And that, look at that photograph. Then we'll have to get it over to Scotty. But isn't that the sweetest picture? I mean, but you can feel the pain.
Yeah.
You can feel the love, but you can feel the pain in his heart. And because you can imagine the relationship that they have, and then of course having to separate and so forth.
Oh yeah, but that'd be tough. That'd be bad.
All right. So that does it for our news. And let's see. Looks like we've talked our way through an hour here. So let's close out this hour. We're going to run Martha's June tip of the month, which is how to deal with animals that have fear of loud noises, thunder, fireworks, that sort of thing. There's some homework involved. So listen up. And then we'll be back and we're going to Africa with Helen and Bill Thayer. Stay with us. Animal World continues right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
The preceding hour of Martha Norwalk's Animal World was brought to you by Jones & Company Pets. Their goal is happy, satisfied customers enjoying happy, healthy pets.
This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KLCK, FM 98.9, Digital HD3 Seattle.
This is Martha with Animal World's Tip of the Month for June. It may seem a little premature to be thinking about the 4th of July now, but it's not at all if you have a dog that is terrified by loud noises like fireworks, especially if you'd like to change that this year. It usually takes some preparation time, but it can be done and is pretty simple. So if you have a dog that is afraid of loud noises like thunder or fireworks, or if you have a young dog that will be experiencing the 4th of July for the first time this year, here's what you need to know to change the way your dog friend feels about fireworks, or to make sure your young dog never becomes afraid. First, let's be sure you know what not to do. None of us like it when our dog acts fearfully, and most of us, even though we have the best of intentions, do exactly the wrong things when our dogs show fear. For example, let's say you're with your dog at home when thunder bangs loudly outside. The dog startles and then begins to cower in fear. Our response is usually to try to calm and sympathize. Oh, poor baby, it's okay. Calm down. It's only thunder. Mommy doesn't like it either. Kiss, kiss, kiss. While we're petting and stroking the dog. Unfortunately, if you do this, you are acknowledging the fear and communicating to the dog that they are behaving appropriately and rewarding the fearful behavior. So their fear will actually become stronger and more deeply seated psychologically. In order to do the right thing under these circumstances, it's important to remember that dogs are pack animals. You, as their human, are supposed to be the leader of the pack. Dogs do follow the leader and tend to be monkey-see-monkey-doers. They are also, for the most part, simple-minded. So if you have a good sales pitch, you can convince them of almost anything. You, as the leader of the pack, must set the appropriate example. You do this by doing what I call jollies or by triggering a formal jolly routine. Either way, success requires you drumming up the actor or actress inside of you. But before we get to that, the first step is understanding and then teaching a jolly routine to your dog. A jolly routine is a word or a phrase that, when you say it, automatically makes your dog think of something wonderful and happy. You can have more than one jolly routine. In fact, I recommend that if there are things you do with your dog on a regular basis that he or she really enjoys, then take advantage of those things by reinforcing the trigger phrases. Let's say your dog likes to go for a walk, or a ride, or play ball. then every time before you do those things, be consistent with the words you say that precede the activity. For example, you know you're going to take the dog for a walk. Before you start the physical part of the ritual, like getting the leash and your coat, begin the trigger phrase, "Let's go for a walk, let's go for a walk, oh boy, let's go for a walk," and repeat it several times before you go into action. That way your dog will react to the words or trigger phrase, not the physical act of actually going for the walk. Just in case you need a jolly trigger out while you're on a walk or playing a game, if your dog likes to eat, I recommend you teach one jolly routine related to a specific special food reward. A food reward, in order to be effective, only has to be large enough to taste. So pick a food that your dog really likes and that he won't get any other time. Make sure it's a food that can be broken up into small pieces like chicken or cheese. You can practice as many jolly routines as you want throughout the day, but there needs to be at least 2 hours between practice jollies. Start your jolly routine when your dog is not expecting it. Say he's asleep on the floor. Before you go into any physical action, remember you want your dog to react to the vocabulary, not the food. Begin saying the trigger phrase. By the way, the food is either already in your pocket and the dog doesn't know you have it, or it's still in the kitchen somewhere. Begin saying, oh boy cheese, let's get cheese, oh boy cheese. Repeat the phrase 5 or 6 times. Then get up and get goofy, exciting your dog as you continue to repeat the phrase. Do this for 2 to 3 minutes, then stop and give the dog the piece of food. If your dog is one of those rare ones that doesn't like food so much, you can do the same thing with their favorite toy or game. Practice the jolly routine until all you have to do is say the trigger phrase and the dog gets excited. Have all members of the family practice jollies. Do it all together as well as doing it separately. Once your dog is programmed, you're ready to use the jolly routine whenever your dog encounters a sound or situation that triggers fear. You hear fireworks? Immediately go into the jolly routine. Now, here's where being a good actor or actress comes in. Put on a good show as you are the leader and making the positive association with the noise. It won't take long before your dog will hear the fireworks and begin the jolly routine himself before you have a chance to. Start your preparation now and you should be good to go by the 4th of July, and even if you haven't done any prep, you can still use the basic concept whenever stuff happens. If you have always sedated your dog over the 4th, I suggest you get the tranquilizers, but prepare for and use jollies. You may find you will be returning the sedatives after the 4th because you didn't need to use them. If you are raising a young dog and this will be their first 4th, your job is to pay attention and be prepared to do jollies on general principles whenever fireworks happen so your dog develops a positive feeling about them. Don't wait to see how the pup reacts. Do the jolly routine as a matter of course. In most cases, I think it's best to exclude your dog from 4th of July celebrations with fireworks, as accidents can happen. Leave your dog at home, inside, with some soft music playing in the background. If you must take your dog to a party, make sure a responsible adult is supervising the dog, and always keep the dog on leash around fireworks. Okay, there you have it, all you need to know to change the way your dog feels about fireworks. But if you still have questions, call me, and please stay tuned because Animal World will be right back.
When the red, red robin comes bob, bob, bobbing along, along, there'll be no more sobbing when he starts robbing his old sweet song. Now wake up, you sleepyhead, get up, get up, get out of bed, cheer up, the sun is red, live, love, laugh and be happy. What if I've been blue, now I'm walking through fields of flowers. Rain may glisten, but still I listen for hours and hours. I'm just a kid again, doing what I did again, singing a song. When the red, red robin starts bob, bob, bobbing along.
The following hour of Martha Norwalk's Animal World is brought to you by Jones & Company Pets. Their goal is happy, satisfied customers enjoying happy, healthy pets.
Hey, good morning, y'all. I'm Martha Norwalk, and welcome you to the second hour of our Father's Day edition of Animal World. We're here every Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150. You can tune us in on the radio dial. You can tune us in on the Internet via streaming audio. That means you can share us with your family and friends around the country, around the world, if they've got Internet access. And the best way to pick up the stream, go to the Animal World website. That would be www.marthanorwalk.com. Click on the Listen Live icon in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. That will click you through to the 1150 KKNW website. Click on Listen Live again, and that will bring up the instructions that you need to stream the show. And I'm delighted to say that two of our most popular guests are in the house, Helen and Bill Thayer. And I got to tell you, if you aren't familiar with these folks, you might be a little depressed about what you've accomplished in your life when you hear what they've done. I have to tell you, Helen and Bill, they are, the founders of Adventure Classroom for Kids and Education. Now, if you haven't checked it out, go to Helen's website, www.helenthayer, that's T-H-A-Y-E-R, helenthayer.com, and take a look at this. In 1988, Helen was the first woman to solo any of the world's poles when she walked alone to the magnetic North Pole, pulling her own sled, unresupplied, without the help of dog teams or snowmobiles. And guess what? Helen was 50 years old. How do you do that? And that's how she got Charlie the wolf dog, because at the last minute, you bought Charlie from the Inuits, for $75 or something to take with you? And good thing you did, or she'd have been probably in the tummy of a polar bear. because Charlie saved her.
Mm-hmm.
And what a dog. And now, 1990, American leader of the first Russian-U.S. World's Arctic Expedition to Siberia and Soviet polar islands. 1992, Helen and Bill were the first married couple to walk to any of the world's poles. They traveled on foot, pulling their own sleds without any resupply, again, to the magnetic North Pole. Bill was the oldest person at 65 to walk to the pole, pulling his own sled without resupply. And in 1994, Helen and Bill spent 1 year with Charlie, their wolf dog canine companion of the magnetic North Pole fame, in the Canadian Yukon and Northwest Territories, studying and photographing three families of wild wolves at their den site. 1995, walked 1,500 miles through Death Valley, Mojave, and the American and Mexican Sonora deserts. 1996, first woman to walk across the Sahara Desert, following an ancient camel trade route of 2,400 miles. 97, Helen walked alone for 550 miles in Antarctica, pulling her own 260-pound sled, unresupplied. During the expedition, this is unbelievable, she celebrated her 60th birthday alone on the polar ice cap with a frozen cupcake and one candle. Can you believe that? 98. She and Bill trekked with the largest caribou herd in the world, 500,000 animals, as they followed their centuries-old tradition of migrating from their wintering grounds in southern Alaska to the North Slope calving grounds. And that's the area up the Arctic wildlife.
That's right.
Sanctuary.
From Central Africa over the Brooks Range to through the North Slope and
to Central Alaska.
Yeah, from Central. They winter over in the Central Alaska, end up on the northern coast.
And let's see, 99, walked 1,200 miles through New Zealand studying the Maori culture. 2000, first non-Indians to kayak 1,200 miles along two rivers in a remote area of the Amazon rainforest. Now, is that the trip you guys had to jump in the piranha-infested river to avoid the swarm of killer bees?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then you got shot at by the natives? And
yes, at one point we were shot at by illegal gold miners.
It's like, and they're still here. Can you believe it? And that's not the end. 2000, trekked 400 miles from northern Canadian Yukon territories to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. 2001, first trek on foot across the entire length of the Mongolian Gobi Desert. They are one of the few people on the planet that has ever seen a Gobi bear. You did that.
That's right.
And that's when you had, who was it? What were your camels?
Tom and Jerry.
Tom and Jerry. Mm-hmm. And then isn't that where you were close to the Chinese border or something? Mm-hmm. And one of the camels got loose and crossed the border. And then you had to go collect the camel because you wouldn't leave him. And then the authorities found you. You almost got shot on the spot.
Yes, we were very close.
But you got out of that in a very interesting way.
Yes, they kept asking the same question over and over again. So finally I got very tired of it and stood up to my full 5'3". This man was much taller than I, and told him that we were his seniors. We figured he was probably in his 30s. And, of course, I was 63. Bill was 74. Told him that Mongolian tradition demands that you respect your seniors, and we are many times your senior. So that made him reflect his position somewhat and decide to be a little kinder and let us go and not shoot us.
Is that amazing? Little 5 foot Helen stands up to the border guard and says, respect your elders, young man. And by golly, he did. And they're alive to tell the story. Now, you're going to want to check out the Adventure Classroom because, boy, if you've got kids, what a great experience to have Helen come. And you do a number of different programs. Reach for the Sky, Make Your Dreams Come True.
Yes,
still do that?
That's the one concerning my walk to the magnetic North Pole. And then Three Among the Wolves is when Bill and I and Charlie, our wolf dog, lived with wild wolves for a year. And then Walking the Gobi is the story of Bill's and my walk.
And you've got three books. Because three of my all-time favorite books of all times. I rarely reread books, but I'll tell you, now, that's how we met, as a matter of fact, when Polar Dream, because that's the story of you and Charlie, your wolf dog, walking to the magnetic North Pole. When that book came out, it was sent to me for review. Mm-hmm. I was doing Animal World on Como back mm-hmm. then. And, boy, I'll never forget you and Bill and Charlie. Wolf Dog was still alive then.
That's right. He came
into the
studio.
Yeah, you all came into the mm-hmm. studio. And, boy, we've been friends ever since.
That's right. And set up a wonderful friendship.
Yeah. What a story. Anyway, I am in awe of these two.
I'm writing Charlie's biography right now, and people are urging me to hurry up and get it done. So I'm hoping to get it done
cool.
by Christmas.
Oh, all right. So first book, Polar Dream. That's your story of that magnetic North Pole.
Yes.
Then the second book, Three Among the Wolves. Mm-hmm. That's the story of living with the wolves in the Arctic. And then
Walking the Gobi.
That's the story of walking the Gobi Desert mm-hmm. with Tom and Jerry and mm-hmm. almost getting killed by the Chinese border guards and so forth. And so the fourth book is Charlie's autobiography?
Yes, and then after Charlie's biography, I want to write about our experiences in the Amazon, and then another book about walking Africa. Well, several thousand miles we've walked in Africa.
Yeah, and because now you have recently returned from your last trip to Africa. How many times have you been to Africa?
Well, we walked across the Sahara Desert its full length, and then we decided to go. We were in other parts of the world. Then we returned to Central Africa, to Tanzania, to study, to live with the Maasai tribe and the Datoga tribe and the Bushman tribe, and also learn about the animals living there, the environment, mm-hmm. the whole scene of animals and the tribal life. And so we did that twice. We went one November, then we went the next February to get the different seasons. And then we decided to return to the Sahara Desert, and we just completed a 900-mile walk in the western countries of the Sahara Desert.
Now this is just very recently.
Yes,
now, let's remind us, and how old are you now, Helen?
I'm 73 and Bill's 84, so we're still a work
in progress. 900 miles in the Sahara?
With our four camels.
74 and 83?
Mm-hmm.
All right, 84. Now how bad do you guys feel now? Gary, how many miles on the beach are you going to walk? Jeez. Unbelievable. You two are amazing. And I swear you look younger today than the last time you were in here. Bill especially. Bill looks really good. Walking 900 miles in the desert in Africa must be good for you, huh?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah, it was very hard at times because we had to go through 40-mile-an-hour headwinds into sandstorms and dust storms. And then, of course, we crossed areas where it's just nothing lives there, nothing. It's just a great flat area with very sterile. It's so hot, so dry.
Now, if I remember correctly, because this was your second trip to Africa in a fairly short period of time,
actually,
wasn't it?
Our third in about 18 months.
Third in about 18 months. So the other and some more preparation for this trip.
Yes, well, we wanted to go back to the. It's very difficult to go into the Sahara now because of so much fighting, so many terrorist camps being set up. So access to the Sahara is becoming extremely limited. But there's one gateway through Morocco, and we decided to take it now before that's closed off.
So you guys left here, and Helen's got great genetics, I got to tell you, because when they leave, they have to leave their property here, which is some acres.
It's 12 acres.
12 acres, and of course you have, we've talked about, we've got the dogs and the cats and the goats and the donkey and all of that. And who do you leave caretaking all of this while you're gone?
My 92-year-old mother.
Can you believe that? Kellen's 92-year-old mom takes care of these 12 acres and all of these animals while they're gone. And she is still bright and chipper as can be.
Yes, she's still dashing through life.
Wow. Wow. All right. So you guys take off from here and fly to Africa. Mm-hmm. And then what happens when you get there?
Well, we flew from here into Casablanca on the coast of northern coast of Morocco, and then we took a domestic flight down to Marrakesh, down to the southern part of Morocco, and there we were met by our contact with a 4x4, and then we drove across the Atlas Mountains. Taking a southern route.
Now, your contact, is this a guide or someone?
No guide. He's a man who takes care of our contacts, tribes. Like, for instance, we told him that we wanted to live with and experience the lifestyle of the Berber Sahara Desert Berber tribe. Mm. So his job was to find a family who would allow us to live with them. Because that's not easy to do.
Do they respect elders as well?
Yeah, they do once you're in.
Getting in is the key. Okay.
Permission to take photos and live their lifestyle and travel with them. So he found a family, which are, a lot of these people are related. So he found an extended family of 12, a 12-member family. And then we could go and we'd have to cross from Morocco into Algeria. But we could travel with them. They were going to have to move to another water supply because the Sahara Desert in many places of water is simply, the water tables are dropping drastically. Mm. So they would have to move. So we could move with them and live their lifestyle, take photos and these sorts of things. So we had that permission in place. So he met us at Marrakesh. We drove through the southern mountains and then into the southern part of Morocco. Then we crossed the border into Algeria and met the family. But things had changed during the time that we'd made the arrangements and we were actually arrived. One of the husband, this man had four wives, seven children, and he decided that because his brother had died and he lived in Timbuktu, but he had two.
Now you mean real Timbuktu?
Yes.
Not when we say Timbuktu. No. There really is a Timbuktu.
Yes, there really is in southern Mali.
Wow.
And so his brother had died, and so it was necessary for tradition demanded that this brother and his family would have to collect the two wives who were now widowed and the four children and bring them into his family. So he would be able to provide and protect them. So then our journey then was to be only 400 miles to begin with, but now it ended up being 900 miles because we had to travel across southern Algeria, northern Mauritania, and northern Mali through some of the most sterile, difficult country in this.
Now I imagine when you say you had to travel through, does that mean you walked?
Yeah, we walked all the way, and Bill and I.
So no all-terrain vehicles cruising the. Okay.
Because these people had sold all their goats and sheep, and they had they just kept 12 camels in order to carry all their household belongings, and so forth. And so the idea was Bill and I had four camels, and we called them Fluffy, Blackie, and George and Henry, and we had our four camels, they had their 12. And so we just became part of their family.
No, well, no. So when you say you had four camels, did you like just use four camels of theirs, or did you have to get camels? Or?
No, our contact got four camels for us.
Oh.
And we actually leased them from his family.
Oh,
everybody's
okay.
Family. Everybody's
family. Everybody's family. So you leased the camels, yes. And of course you had to name them.
Yeah, we had to name
well,
them.
Well, you shared in the Mongolian desert, you shared some stuff with Tom and Jerry.
Yes, yeah.
Our idea
is when we, because we really love camels. They're very nice animals. And they, I know they have a bad reputation, but when they're treated well and with respect, they're wonderful. And so.
Did you hear that? But when they're treated well with respect?
Yeah, that's it. That's the whole thing is all about respect. Yeah. Don't treat them as a dumb animal. Treat them as an intelligent.
And you had
animal.
Already, and I believe that there is like a mass consciousness of species, and so you had already forged a really good relationship with camels with Tom and Jerry, and I would imagine that helped you with these
camels. The first journey across the Sahara, then camels again in the Gobi. And now camels are camels again. Now.
Yeah, so camels, you're part of the camel family.
And we, that's right. That's how we feel. And so we walk, and by walking, we can put our equivalent to our weight in extra food, mostly grain for the camels. This way we make sure the camels come out the other end as good, at least as good as they go in. And we only have the very best, very, very well-conditioned camels. So we loaded up our four camels, and we joined the family with their 12 camels, and off we went.
So did the camels pack everything for you, or did you have to carry things as well?
We carried small backpacks.
Small backpacks, okay.
Just with emergency gear, if something happens and something happens to the camels, you're not left with nothing.
Well, because I'm remembering, in the Mongolian desert, you guys almost died.
Because
what was it, Tom, or just somebody rolled and broke your water, and you had no water then?
No. So what we do now is we always carry a small pack with some water in it.
Oh, okay. You learned from that experience.
A first aid kit, as much water as we can carry and reasonably carry, and some food just for emergency. The rest goes on the camels.
Okay.
So we set off with them, and we went across some of the most desolate Hamada, the plains, stony plains, that are so flat you could feel as though you could play billiards on them.
Wow.
And but when the wind kicks up, there's tremendous dust storms, and it just feels as though you're walking to the ends of the earth. It's just that the earth just never seems to end. You just know that must be the end, way out there must be, we're going to fall off the end of the earth. It's so far away.
Wow.
And then and of course everything is so tiny. The distance is so vast, and you can look around you, and it's just so vast, you can't tell size. The size just is irrelevant.
It just like goes on forever and ever?
Yeah, and you're so tiny.
And so it's you and the family that you're traveling with, and they have 12 camels, you have four. Are those the only animals that are with you?
Yes. They didn't have any, they had sold all their goats and sheep because they were moving to another area.
So what about when you guys are trekking across, from wherever you're going? Are there other animals out in the desert that
not
you have?
Not very many. We don't have access. The most important thing is to go from well to water well to water well.
Okay.
And hope you don't miss any. But we were actually traveling a very ancient trade route. It just happened that this was the convenient route that had been traveled many. It was first reported in the 11th century by Arab geographers as being a trade route from Morocco going south down through southern Algeria, northern Mauritania, northern Mali to the salt mine. There's many different spellings of this, but one is Tazhada. And this is called the Tazhada route.
Mm.
And it's centuries old. Huge caravans of, in ancient days, huge caravans of camels, of many thousands of camels, would travel down to northern Mali to the salt mines there, and then pick up big slabs of salt on the camels, travel on down to Timbuktu, and exchange the salt for gold and slaves, and then transport the gold and slaves back to Morocco, and then on to the various worldwide markets. And that was going on centuries ago. And now, of course, it's not the slave trade nor the gold trade, but now the salt trade still continues, especially from Timbuktu, going north to the mines. Now, we were going from Morocco on the northern section of that route, from Morocco down, we just stopped just north of the salt mines, because down, farther on down, there are terrorist camps and so forth. Mm. So these are two widows and her and their children were driven by two Tuareg tribesmen north to where we could meet them. And we met them there. Then we turned around and followed the same ancient route.
So how many in the family that you were traveling with?
There were 12 in the family that we traveled with. There were 12 people. Then they had their 12 camels. Then we picked up the two widows and their four children.
So in the 12 people in the family, what was that comprised of in terms of adults or kids?
There were four wives and seven children and one husband.
Four wives, seven children, one husband.
Yes.
Okay. And then you hooked up with two widows that were related to these?
They would be the sister-in-laws of the husband.
I gotcha.
So that's why he was taking them. He had to go get them and bring them into his family to provide
them. I'm wondering, because you knew to hook up, how do they communicate with one another over all those distances?
They just communicate across the desert, and they can go to Timbuktu does have a phone service of sorts, and our family that we're traveling with, they could go and communicate like that. And there is communication.
Now, I'm wondering how you, because they obviously don't speak English, do they?
No, they speak French, because Northern Africa was occupied by and colonized by the French, and then, of course, it was all they left. So French is the strongest foreign language. But they speak the language Arabic and Berber. But we had our contact chosen this family. One reason was that the husband of the family could speak some English. So we were very fortunate there, because he searches around and finds just the right families, the right tribal people that we
that will work for you. Because am I remembering correctly? Because I think that often you learn some of the native language, don't you? Because
you
speak a lot of all kinds of different things.
Reasonable of many different, but of course, when you don't speak it for a while, you lose it, and then you have to pick it up again when you go back. But so we were very fortunate there, because then we were able to speak and just find out exactly what these people think and what they believe and how they travel. But actually traveling with them, a day after day after day for 900 miles, that we were actually out there for 50 days, because we were traveling, I think it was for about 45 days, and we had 5 days of no travel due to sandstorms, or if we would come to a place where there was grazing, because normally you wouldn't call it grazing by our standards, but a few wisps of grass and so forth, stop and allow the camels to rest and eat whatever they could there. And then the main water wells, we did stay at one for a day just to make sure we had plenty of water, the camels had plenty of water, because then we had no more water. We knew there would be no more water going south.
Mm.
So we'd have to go south and then come back again.
So what kind of you said you stayed for a day at that water well, do you like set up tents or something?
Just tents, yeah.
Just tents.
Okay. Or just sleep on the ground.
Or sleep on the ground, okay.
You have a camel blanket that you put over the camel, then you load on top of that. You can use that camel to wrap yourself up in. Sometimes that's the easiest thing to do during a sandstorm. If it's very bad and you can't continue, it's just to simply stop and have the camel's couch or kneel down on the ground, and then you just take the camel blanket off, and they're very thick, and you roll yourself up in with your back to the wind and just sleep it out.
Wow.
And then, of course, you wake up and you've got a lot of sand is built up against you, but, you know, you're protected.
I can't imagine being in that kind of sand, because that must be like just, if it blows in your face, it'd be like sandpaper worse.
The best way to protect yourself against the sun and the sand and sandstorm is to simply cover up. And so we wear, goggles. Glasses to protect our eyes, but we also wrap our whole face and head in two layers of a sort of rather a coarse gauze scarf-like material.
So that's why when we see natives from areas like this, why they're all wrapped up.
Yes.
And what are we talking about weather-wise and temperatures and
stuff?
Well,
we were there in the winter. Winter is from...
Winter for them.
Yes, for their winter starts about October and ends by the end of May. And June's getting too warm. You really don't want to be in the desert then if you can help it. And so we didn't get much above 90 degrees.
Oh, gee.
And then, but now then it can drop 40 or 50 degrees at night very
easily.
Oh, wow. But it's amazing. We were comparing and coming back to our climate here in the Northwest. It's amazing. It can drop down, say, like 40 degrees or something like that. And Bill and I both remarked we'd step out of the tent in the morning, and it's such a dry cold.
I was going to say, it must be very dry climate.
Extremely dry.
It would be 40, 41 degrees some mornings.
44 degrees some mornings, Bill says?
But 40 degrees here in the morning, I'm cold.
Yeah.
Bill's saying that 40 degrees here, you're cold, but 40 degrees there, it's so dry, you don't feel cold?
Because there's no dampness.
There's no dampness.
It's extremely dry.
Okay, that makes sense.
And you have to drink more water because it's so dry, so dry.
Is the heat easier to tolerate because it's dry as well, or is it just as bad?
Heat is heat. Heat sucks the energy right out of you, but... At 90 degrees in the dry heat, we did pretty well. Just drink enough, and because we walk everywhere, we won't ride camels. We're not riders.
I was going to say you're not riding the camels.
No.
They're carrying stuff.
Yeah,
you're walking.
That's right. We don't like to ride. We find it very uncomfortable. We have done it just to say we've done it, but we're not riders. We feel it's better for the camel's sake to put our weight and food on their extra food on their back so that they're better taken care of. We're more comfortable walking. It's only when you walk that you can get the real feel of the desert. Mm-hmm. You become one with that environment. You're traveling over these enormous plains. It's just so vast, it's hard to describe them. They're just so vast. And then there are the sand dunes you have to deal with.
I was just wondering, when you're traveling, I think of like walking on, you know, like Gary's going to the ocean and the coast and walking in the sand. Mm-hmm. Walking in the sand can be a lot of work.
Yeah, it can be because
it isn't a flat surface.
No.
So is that when you're walking the desert in Africa, are you walking through sand that makes it more difficult to walk, or is it so blowy that
when you come to areas of sand dunes, they can be 10, 20 feet high, or 40 or 50, 60 and several hundred feet high, and then you have to take your camels, so you're leading your camels through the valleys of the sand dunes. Mm. You don't want to go up and over the top of a sand dune if you can possibly help it, because camels don't, they're not good at going down steep sides. They're not very agile and they can break a leg. You have to be very careful of them. And of course you don't want to be too hard on your camels or yourself, so you lead your camels through the valleys of these great sand dunes and just try to avoid going up and over if you can. Then that means you walk extra miles, you're going through these places. And then if the wind is blowing, that wind is streaming that sand off in your face. And because we had camera gear, by the time we got our camera gear back home, it took $800 to clean those cameras.
Clean the sand out of the cameras and stuff?
It was grating, even, you know, on the telephoto lens, you could feel and hear the grating of the lenses. But everything worked. We came back with fabulous photography.
And you can wonder, how can, you know, 74 and 83-year-old people do this? But it's not like you come home here to the Northwest and sit on your duffs and do nothing. You are always preparing and keeping yourself in condition.
We work out all the time. We constantly...
And just how many times have you climbed Mount Rainier?
21 to the summit.
and you guys, like, you go off on treks
We live in the foothills of the Cascades, of course, which is a wonderful place for us because we're close to all those wonderful trails and the Pacific Crest Trail. And so each summer, summer before last, we walked from Snoqualmie to Stevens Pass. And then last summer we did the same thing. This summer,
Scotty and I had trouble driving from Leavenworth to what blew it past. And you guys walked from,
this summer when the snow clears, we're going to go from Stevens to Snoqualmie.
You're going to walk?
Yeah, walk the Pacific Crest Trail.
Wow.
It's not even 100 miles, but it's very good, very good training.
Now, you just walk or do you pack stuff when you're...
take backpacks.
We do twice a week, 2 hours a day.
Twice a week, 2 hours a day, pack and walk?
Yeah, we walk 7.5 miles very fast, hard walking, using good technique for walking, and you know, like not quite a race walk, and with packs, and we're just waiting for the snows to disappear out of the mountains, and then we'll be up on the trails in the mountains.
It's amazing how much snow we still have,
Well, the trails we like to go to and for our training are up high. They're the more difficult trails, and there's feet and feet of snow up there yet, and it's not melting very fast.
No, I think they're still skiing, aren't they, in the passes and stuff?
Yes, some of them, some Crystal Mountain they are. But now the avalanche danger is not, it's quite high, and then, of course, it's all covered up with snow. You can get off the trail and get into gully systems you shouldn't be in. And
wow. So I just want you folks to get an idea that what Helen and Bill do to keep themselves in shape and be prepared for this sort of thing. So you really do keep your bodies in good shape.
We also lift weights. We have our own gym. So we lift weights and we stretch, lift weights, and we hike hard and fast. And so all the time.
So they may look small, folks, but they are tough. And all muscle, I think. So you were prepared for this 900-mile walk as best as you could be.
We would never take anything on unless we knew that we have to know that we can make it and we can make it comfortably. We don't want to be dragging along someplace, and we have to do it comfortably because you know, we're there to learn and experience, to bring back an educational project for Adventure Classroom and we have some trees to deal with on our property, that noble fir, 100-foot noble fir to come down and then clean up. So we have all this farm work and jobs to do as well.
So you work your own farm and take care of your own land. And your farm isn't like, you know, a flat, easy,
you
get on the riding mower and take care of it. You got to be a mountain climber just to deal with their own property.
It's very hilly. There's hardly any flat on it at all. We have to be a mountain goat to... But it's all good. It's good training for us just to live where we live.
Yeah, yeah.
So we don't do the rocking chair thing.
That's for sure. That's for sure. So okay, let's go back. We're in the doing this trek, and you really were traveling most of the time.
We had to. You can travel about walking with your camels, leading your camels. You can walk about 2.5 miles an hour, and we were doing 10, sometimes 12-hour days, but usually only 10-hour days.
So what, maybe like 20 miles a day then?
Yes, we average about 20 miles a day on the days that we traveled. And then because you have to be careful of your camels, you don't want to stress them, you don't want them to get too tired. It really doesn't matter whether we get tired.
It sounds like we care more about the camels than we do about the humans.
You've got to care more about them because...
Well, your life really depends on them, right?
It does, because they're carrying all your gear and your water. And you've got to get to that next well. Because if you miss that, if you navigate... if your navigation is off and you miss that well, then you can easily miss a well because you can't just search a way out there. Oh, there's the well. I walk over there. You can't see them. It's so vast. And sometimes a well is only a hole in the ground. It has no casing on top. And you have to know that it's there and just lift a lid off this place on the ground.
It's wow.
So you have to...
Like a sewer in our streets, the cap
just lift
there.
That off, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just... Wow, you really... Now, so how are you navigating? Do you use, GPS
nomads,
systems or something?
No, the nomads, no. They know where these wells are.
No GPS. You have to know.
It's in their head.
Ah.
And they use the stars and all the rest of it. They know where...
So we're talking true navigating.
Yeah. They know where they are because, you know, this route has been traveled well... It's an ancient travel route, and the wells are spaced out, but some of them are dry, and some of them are not doing well, becoming...
That's what you said, the water table is going lower and lower.
But these people, they know word of mouth through the desert, through the other, because it's a nomadic society, and they know where the wells are. And so your camels, you have to take care of your camels.
So is their life and where they live dependent on where the water is?
Yes. Oh, yes, because without water, you can't live.
And you said that's why this family was moving?
They were moving into another mountain system and returning to Morocco. Yes.
Like the nomads in the Gobi, Bill was saying.
Always search for water. And these people wanted to move back into the mountains of Morocco. to where, again, they had more extended family there. That's where they actually came from originally. And they had moved into Algeria, but years ago, and now they decide they needed to go back because the water wasn't, they were having problems with water. But first of all, they had to had to go and meet their extended family, the widow, the ladies who are widowed now, widows, and bring them back and travel that long journey back and then cross back into Morocco and go into the mountains to where there was a spring system there.
Now was this a relatively smooth trek for you guys, or did you have any harrowing experiences?
As far as life-threatening, no. Nobody threatened to shoot us at all.
Well, you've had enough of those, I think.
But it was just mostly putting one foot in front of the other, getting through the sandstorms and just getting through those vast, open, wide-open plains that are just stony. You call them hamadas or eggs, and there's just stony plains go on forever. Then, of course, you come to the sand dunes, and the sand dunes always seem to be oriented north from like north to south, north, I'd say northeast to basically northeast to southwest across our path. So we had to go across them. We couldn't go, go along the grain of them. They weren't going the same direction as we were.
Huh.
So you have to cross them. That made it more difficult.
No, I'm wondering that since you were traveling the vast majority of this time, how were you able to get to know this family?
You're walking with them.
So is it such that you would be able to talk while you're walking
you
and so forth?
While you walk and talk in the tent.
I was wondering about night. So would you set up a tent that you all stayed in, or did you have individual tents?
We had our own tent, but they had a big, big community tent. And so we'd cook and go collect firewood and stuff to make a fire. And then they would make
So there would be fire in the wood in the desert that you'd be able to find?
Little bits of twigs and roots.
Twigs and roots, okay.
And under the ground, you see little twigs coming up above the ground. There's roots under there, and you can get those. They're dead, and so because
they
of the,
burn.
Because most of the area that we had traveled through hadn't seen rain in about 7 years.
7 years?
And then it was just a little shower.
Holy moly.
We actually photographed the most amazing photograph of a rainbow I've ever photographed. We were crossing this wide open plain. It was so vast. It was indescribable. And this rainbow came up and went from horizon to horizon. And I have this photo of this brightly colored rainbow from horizon to horizon. Nothing interrupted it.
Wow.
And it was just amazing because normally there's a mountain range or there's something where you don't see the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, you rarely see a whole rainbow.
Ends. It was extraordinary just to have this huge arch. Well, then there was a tiny, tiny shower came out of that, which really did nothing, no good. But it wasn't rain. It just burns off in the atmosphere.
Wow!
But that was the closest. But it's
now, so what kind of food did you pack? So you said in the evening you cooked.
Well, these people eat an extraordinary, a very, very healthy diet. Extraordinary amount of fruits and vegetables.
Where do you get those?
Well, they packed them before they left from the local market.
Those goats, they can keep the meat for about 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the meat from they can keep for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the tomatoes and cucumbers and stuff like that. And they bake bread in the sand. They have a mixture of flour, wheat flour. And they put a yeast in it, and then they just mix that, pour water in it. In the meantime, they have a little pit, a shallow pit in the sand, and they light a fire in it to make the sands very, very, very hot.
Mm.
And then they mix the dough in a big bowl, and then they put the dough, and they put it into a big flat patty, like might be like about a foot wide by a foot round, and then they scoop the hot sand out, and then they put this dough in there, then cover it up with the sand.
But right on the sand?
Yeah.
They put the dough on the sand?
In the little pit in the sand, then they put the very, 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 very hot sand that they've heated up with the fire on top. And then you sit back, and you watch the sand rise.
Oh.
As the bread is rising.
Well, so then isn't your bread all covered with sand, though, after it's
cooked? Yeah, and then they tap it, and they can tell, you know, when it's cooked. And then they uncover the sand, and then they just scrape the sand off and then cut it up, and you've got some great bread. And it's got some sand, but you're used to sand. You know, you have to just get used to it because sand is in everything. Sand just creeps. It just creeps into everything.
Oh, I can.
It's in everything. You can't avoid it.
Well, I'm remembering times, not, of course, never been to Africa in the desert, but more like the beach in Mexico or Hawaii and rolling around in the waves and then, you know, for days getting sand out of body parts and so forth. And I would imagine the same sort of thing.
Sand is everywhere.
All right. Well, let's take care of our advertisers and sponsors here. Remember, it is the most important part of the show because without them, there's no us, folks. So, my microphone's wiggling a little bit, and I was actually going to mess with it, but it's different than the other one, so I think I better not mess with it, Gary.
It's Martha proof.
Is it Martha proof? It won't. Well, I don't know it because it looks like it could unscrew and fall off. Well, never mind. We're going to take care of our advertisers and sponsors. Please pay attention and support them because without them, there's no us. And we continue with Adventure Travelers Helen and Bill Thayer straight ahead right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150. Hey, did you know that even if you feed the highest quality all-natural food, even if you home cook for your animal friends, the ingredients in that food is exposed to heat, light, and oxygen, and that begins to destroy a lot of the important stuff. Well, that's why Designing Health has created the missing link. Now, they start with human-grade, all-whole natural raw food stuff. They've figured out a way to protect it from heat, light, and oxygen. And you keep it refrigerated. Once you open it, it comes in a resealable gold foil pouch in a powdered form. Mix up your animal friend's food, add in the missing link, a little cool water to mix it up, and voila, you've added what's missing. Like the balanced omega-3, 6, and 9 oils, the enzymes in the raw ingredients, the fiber, the missing link tends to eliminate excessive shedding problems in dogs, eliminates hairball problems in cats, and there is a missing link formula for dogs, one for cats. There's a vegetarian formula, and you can feed that to both your dogs and cats and other house critters like rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, and so forth. There is a bird formula and a horse formula and a missing link plus with glucosamine for connective tissue and joint support and a dog and horse formula. So ask for the missing link wherever you shop for premium pet supplies, or you can go directly to Designing Health. You can give them a call at 1-800-774-7387. That's 1-800-774-7387, or visit them online at www.designinghealth.com.
We all want the best possible health for our animal companions. At Nature's Logic, we believe the highest quality and safest nutrition for your pet comes from whole foods, not chemistry labs. So we've created the first and only full line of kibble, canned, and raw pet foods containing no synthetic vitamins or minerals. Nature's Logic uses only whole foods and 100% natural ingredients to provide your dog or cat with complete and balanced nutrition. To learn more about Nature's Logic or to find a retailer, please visit natureslogic.com.
Does your dog experience bad breath or gas? Does your cat spit up hairballs? Try Optigest. Optigest is a natural formula of digestive enzymes and the prebiotic FOS. Even pets with a healthy diet can experience digestive upset due to diet change, separation, or the normal aging process. Optigest works fast and has no inactive ingredients. Optigest supports intestinal balance and a healthy immune system to promote more comfortable, active, and vibrant dogs and cats. Ask for Optigest at your natural pet store today. Massage is good for everyone, including your pets.
Learn animal massage close to home at the Northwest School of Animal Massage. The Northwest School of Animal Massage offers a full schedule of classes, including massage for canines, small and large animal certification, and equine ligament therapy.
For more information, go to nwsam.com or call 877-836-3703. Locally, call 425-222-3703. That's 425-222-3703.
Join their Facebook page for exciting announcements and the latest class updates.
The latest must-have for dog owners is a custom-made breeze guard, a powder-coated welded wire mesh screen that quickly and easily fits in your car's windows. BreezeGuard keeps your dog in the car with the windows open. It keeps strangers' hands out of the vehicle and gives you peace of mind that your dog is safe and happy in your car, parked or moving. Go to BreezeGuard.net for complete product details and information on ordering BreezeGuards. Your dog will love you for this. Check out BreezeGuards now at the Redmond Saturday Market.
Urine contamination is a common and stubborn problem. Conventional cleaning methods are not the answer. Anti-Icky Poo works quickly and naturally, and it's my all-time absolute favorite odor neutralizer. This unique bacteria enzyme solution converts the waste directly into carbon dioxide, a safe and odorless gas found in everyday clean air. Ask your vet for Anti-Icky Poo or call 1-800-745-1671. Anti-Icky Poo, it's a serious product with a funny name that really works, especially on cat urine. 1-800-745-1671.
Since 1935, Evinger's Dog and Cat Food Company has been the finest natural dog food company in the United States. For over 75 years, they have innovated products dedicated to wholesome nutrition free of harmful additives and preservatives. Premium quality cuts of USDA human grade meat and poultry with market fresh fruits and vegetables compose their revered recipes. No corn, wheat, or soy. No fillers or byproducts. No additives or preservatives. Nothing artificial. Just abundant, wholesome ingredients. Make it easy to say yes to Evinger's. Visit online for more information at evingersdogandcatfood.com.
Going against the grain has never been so much fun. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Well, hey, y'all, Martha Norwalk, and we're winding down the second hour of our Father's Day edition. Adventure travelers Helen and Bill Thayer are here, and we're going to get educated about camels here real quick, because we're in the African desert, if you haven't figured that out. Sand, and we got sand in all crevices of our body right now, and coating the bread that they're baking in little sand ovens. Very cool. Anyway, but I want to do a quick current events. Not a whole lot of new stuff here, but I want you to be sure and go to the Animal World website, MarthaNorwalk.com. Click on current events, because the first listing is to how to help our little old ladies in the high desert of Arizona. And they're I only call them that because they call themselves that. And they're kind of like the Helen and Bill of the high desert of Arizona, rescuing animals and living off the land, and incredible, incredible stories. And they are in dire need of money, not only to take care of themselves and their animals and their own evacuation, but as they're getting themselves evacuated, they've got to get back and evacuate some neighbors. Of course, you know, they're miles away from their closest neighbor, but there are other elderly folks up in this high desert that have lots of animals and need help evacuating, and they need money to do it. So I want you to check it out. It's the first listing on current events, MarthaNorwalk.com, and there is a special account has been set up at Chase Bank, so you can go to any Chase Bank and donate to the Willa D. Wildfire Relief Fund. Willa, W-I-L-L-A-D-D-E-E, Wildfire Relief Fund. And if you can't do that, you can send a check directly to me, made out to the Willa D. Wildlife Relief Fund, and I'll take it to Chase Bank. There's also a link to Robin Alexis's website on her homepage, robinalexis.com. There is a link to the stream, Help the Victims of the Arizona Fire, and all the reports, as many as we've posted so far, at least from Willa and Dee, and what's been going on with them. Now, keep your calendars marked. We will be broadcasting live Sunday, July 10th, from the America's Family Pet Expo at the Puyallup Fairgrounds and Event Center. The expo actually happens July 8, 9, and 10. We'll be there Sunday morning, July 10th. And you can check it out at www.petexpowa.org. Make sure you get to the Redmond Market some Saturday here real soon and check out the Breeze Guards. I was just telling Helen about them, and she's going to be checking them out on the website. Because now that she knows about him, I'm sure, like she was just telling me, that she and Bill are a little nervous about leaving their dogs in the car, because the car can be taken with the animals with it, but the car's actually more secure with the Breeze Guards in it than it is without it. Now, Humane Society is starting to free spay and neuter surgeries for pit bulls and pit bull mixes in King County. free vaccinations, and microchips are only $5. So www.seattlehumane.org or call 425-649-7560 for an appointment. Positive Alliance, Mutt Match, and Cool Cats Adoption Event Sunday, June 26th from noon to 3 p.m. at Bellevue PetSmart. And, well, let's see, Posado's annual bark at Marymore Park is July 31st. And, let's see, Meow's annual Fine Wines and Felines is on Saturday, July 16th. So I think that covers the important stuff. Check out my website, marthanorwalk.com. Click on current events for details that you missed and all of the other stuff that I didn't mention. Well, and let's see. We are close enough to the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and close out our second hour here. We'll get started with the third hour.